about this evening. I asked you to be thinking of what book in the Bible was going to meet the criteria that I presented to you last evening, and I've been asking a variety of different people, and I'm utterly astounded at the variety of answers that I've got, and not one person has guessed the book. So I have my work cut out for me this evening. I have got to prove to a lot of cynical, skeptical people out there that the book that I'm going to nominate for that distinctive role is the book that I'm going to be presenting, and I hope that we can have some great times discovering that this book, one of the books with which you are most familiar, really does play a very unique and distinctive role in the Bible that most of us simply are unaware of. And so my objective is to try to help us all to understand that role and to let the impact of that role really affect the direction of our lives in our study together during this week. William Jennings Bryan was a very outstanding Christian. He was a great student of the Scriptures. He was a bold, outspoken Christian. For many of us, he is best known as the defense attorney in the very famous Scopes trial. The Scopes trial took place in the United States about a century ago, when creationism and evolution was officially debated in the courts of the United States. And the defender of the creationist position was a lawyer by the name of William Jennings Bryan. He is less known to many of us at this time as being the three-time candidate of the Democratic Party in the United States for the presidency of that country. On one occasion in the year 1896, he gave his great speech at the very first of those three Democratic conventions, at which he was voted as the candidate for the party for the presidency of the United States. And after he gave that speech, the speech that obviously won him a great deal of support and acclaim, a friend turned to him and said, "I suppose many times before you have made just as able a speech as that, and it was never remembered." William Jennings Bryan quietly responded to him and said, "Yes, I suppose that's true. But that convention was my opportunity, and I made the most of it." The two were riding in the back seat of a taxi of some sorts. William Jennings Bryan was a huge man with a large head physically, rested his head on a cushion at the back of that seat, closed his eyes, reflected for a quiet moment, and then turned to his friend sitting in the back seat and said some very, very profound words. He turned to him and said, "And I suppose that's about all we do in this life, lose or use our opportunities." And I propose to you, ladies and gentlemen, that those are very profound words. The fact of the matter is that in the history of the Christian church over 2,000 years, about all that we have done is lose or use our opportunities. The fact of the matter is, about all your church has done in the history of that local church is lose or use its opportunity. And the fact of the matter is that about all that you've done in life is either lose or use the opportunities that God has given to you. Whether it's the church worldwide, whether it's the local church, whether it's the individual Christian, it can, with some sensitivity, be said, we are what we are because of what we do with our opportunities. And about all we do with the opportunities is we lose them or we use them. Which of these two alternatives is largely determined by one factor. And it's that factor that we're going to study tonight, and that we're going to be studying all the rest of this week in our evening sessions. That factor, I suspect, is best illustrated in the Bible from a story that's found in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. Let me ask you to turn in your Bible, please, to Numbers chapter 13, and we will break in to perhaps one of the great, great moments in the history of the nation of Israel. I suppose it's no stretch of anyone's imagination to propose to you that at this point, this generation is now facing the greatest opportunity of their life. This generation has been in bondage in Egypt under the great delivering power of God. This generation has been redeemed from Egypt. They've crossed the Red Sea. They've moved out into the wilderness. They visited Mount Sinai, and now they have come to the destination, the land of Canaan. They're right on the border. Before them is the land that God has promised to them. It's the land to which they have been journeying. It's the land that in every respect stands as a stark contrast with their experience in the wilderness during the last 2 years and the experience of the nation in Egypt for the last 430 years. It's no stretch of anyone's imagination to sense that at this point in Kadesh Barnea, this generation is facing the greatest opportunity of their life. They have two options. They can blow it, or they can take advantage of it. We know the story, but let's get the setting in our minds clearly. Under the direction of God, Moses chooses 12 spies. The spies are sent into the land, they do their thing, and in due course, the 12 spies return. There is, of course, there are two reports that are given. The majority report comes from 10 spies. We read that report in chapter 13, verse 31. Where we read, "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us.' So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, a part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight.'" Three things, obviously, about the majority report. The people who are giving this report, first of all, saw the dangers in the land of Canaan. Secondly, they saw the greatness of the Canaanites. And thirdly, they saw the weakness of themselves. Conclusion? No way. There's no way that we can take this land. It would be utter folly for us to cross the border and to move in and to claim the land that God has given to us. It'd be utterly ridiculous for us to believe that God could give this land to us. And so the majority report is delivered. The first few verses of chapter 14 tell the sad story of the response of the Israelites. They first of all have a major pity party, feeling very sorry for themselves. Then they begin to malign the very character and the goodness of God in bringing them to this point. And then, with a sweep of their hands, they vote out of office the leadership that God has placed in the office of leadership, Moses and Aaron. They're just about to cast their ballots that will decide on their course of action when the scene is interrupted by the minority report. Two men stand up. Their names are Joshua and Caleb. Verse 6, chapter 14, we read, "And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. They spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we pass through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land.'" The first thing that they saw was the goodness of the land. "If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land,
and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. They saw the greatness of God. Verse 9, only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them. They saw the weakness of the enemy. Now, I hope you've seen the sharp contrast. The majority saw the dangers of the land. The minority saw the goodness of the land. The majority saw the greatness of the enemy. The minority saw the greatness of God. The majority saw the weakness of themselves. The minority saw the weakness of the enemy. What they saw was radically different. How could 12 men see exactly the same thing, but see it so radically differently? Well, the vote is cast. Ballots are placed in the box. The tally is delivered. The decision, there's no way that we're going to move into this land and take this land. Now, interestingly, turn over, if you will, please, to Hebrews chapter 3. Because in Hebrews 3, you have the inspired divine commentary on the incident that we have just read. Hebrews chapter 3. There's a little commentary by the author on the incident, and then the assessment, the analysis is given in the concluding verse of chapter 3, which says, and so we see they were not able to enter because of unbelief. The generation lost the greatest opportunity of their life because they were not ready to trust God and to step out in obedience to God and to take the land. And as a result, they lost the greatest opportunity of their life. You know the consequence, of course. They shift into reverse. Back into the wilderness they travel. The next 38 years are crowded with funerals. I mean, that's all they did all day long. It was just funeral, funeral, funeral. They traveled in a small circle, and they just buried people. Everyone 20 years of age and over, in Numbers chapters 13 and 14, were disqualified from entering into the land because of their unbelief. And so for 38 years, they wander in the wilderness while those people, 20 years of age and over, die off and are buried in the wilderness. Now, it's very significant, ladies and gentlemen, that while one generation is dying off and being buried because of unbelief, a second generation is growing up. You see, there are all those teenagers in Numbers 13 and 14. They listen to their dad as their dad voted. They listen to some of the spies, perhaps dads and grandpas and uncles, who came back with the report. They were part of the audience. They saw what had happened. They weren't held responsible because they weren't voting members of the nation at that time. But here this generation of 4-year-olds and 14-year-olds are now growing up. So as one generation is fading off and dying in the wilderness, a new generation is growing up. They're coming to marriageable age. They begin to marry. They begin to have children. There's a whole new generation of young couples, young families that are growing up in the wilderness. Moses knows that this generation one day is going to face the greatest opportunity of their life. They're going to come to the edge of the land of Canaan. Before them is going to be all that God has promised them. Behind them is going to be a clear word from God. It's yours. Go on. I've given it to you. Move in. Go ahead and take it. The question that Moses struggles with as their nation leader, will this next generation be able to believe God? Will they be ready to trust God? And will they demonstrate that belief and that trust by stepping out and going in and taking the land? His question. The first generation lost the greatest opportunity of their life and are dying in the wilderness. The second generation, will they lose? Or will they use their opportunity? Why did the first generation lose? Because they were not able to believe God. If the second generation is going to use their opportunity, if they're going to take the land, if they're going to possess all that God has promised them, if they're going to enjoy all that God has provided for them, then Moses knows that this generation needs to have a faith that's ready to believe God, willing to trust God, and ready to demonstrate that by stepping out with a lifestyle of obedience to God. So what does Moses do? Moses sits down and he writes a book. And the book that he writes is primarily written for this young generation, young couples, young families that are growing up in the wilderness. The purpose of the book is to feed their faith, to feed that faith, to keep feeding that faith, so that when opportunity knocks, when they come to the edge of a land, when the Jordan River is before them, the walls of Jericho are there, the armies of the Canaanites are there, this generation will be able to believe God and step out in obedience to God and take the land that God has given to them. What book does Moses write? Well, I've narrowed it down for you now, haven't I? See, nobody guessed any one of the books of Moses. I had Hebrews guessed, I had John guessed, I had Philippians guessed, I had Job guessed, I had Psalms guessed. I think if I waited long enough, I would have had about 50 or 60 different books nominated. It comes from Moses. And he writes a book that's designed to feed the faith of this young generation so that they'll be ready to trust God and willing to step out in obedience to God when God says go for it. Well, you've guessed it, haven't you? The very first book of your Bible. It's the book of Genesis. Isn't it amazing that we never think of Genesis in the light of its historical setting? Now, I need to acknowledge to you that many of the books of the Bible have a clear statement of purpose. You know, for example, John's Gospel was written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And there are a number of books in the Bible that have a clear statement of purpose, sometimes at the middle of the front of the book, sometimes at the end of the book. Now, in Genesis, there is no statement of purpose. So when you come to a book in the Bible that doesn't have a statement of purpose, what you do is you take that book and put it into its historical setting. And then look at what the author writes and say, now, why does the author write that in this particular historical setting? And that's what we're going to do this evening and what we'll be doing with some of the special stories we will look at all during the rest of this week in our evening sessions. We put it into its historical setting. Genesis is written during those 38 years while one generation is dying off and being buried while a new generation is growing up. Moses knows that the first generation blew it. He's deeply concerned about the second generation that they won't blow it. And he's a good leader. He wants to train them. He wants to feed their faith. He wants to prepare them so that when opportunity knocks, they'll be ready to believe God and they'll be willing to step out and trust God and move in and take all that God has for them. So he writes the book of Genesis in order to do that. We're going to look at some of the familiar stories in the book of Genesis and at one or two not so familiar stories. And we're going to discover that when we look at those stories with the perspective I've just given to you, It's going to change our whole perspective on this wonderful book of Genesis. Now let me ask you, you're a mom or you're a dad, you're a Sunday school teacher, you're a Bible class teacher, you're an elder in your church or your assembly, and one of the things that you do, either officially or unofficially, one of the things that you do regularly or sporadically, is that you teach others. And if you were in Moses' position, that is, if your responsibility was to take this young generation and teach them something that would feed their faith so that they would grow up to be a generation that was really able to believe God and ready to trust God and willing to step out in obedience to God, what would you feed them? You see, that's my question. What would you feed them? Supposing that was your purpose, your objective, for a Bible class that you're going to teach this fall, what would be your curriculum? You see, my question really is, what kind of food really feeds faith so that faith becomes strong, faith becomes vital, faith becomes vibrant, faith becomes so powerful that when God speaks, we're able to believe Him, and we're willing to trust Him, and we're committed to stepping out in obedience to Him. What kind of food feeds that kind of faith? Well, let's turn to the book of Genesis, because tonight what we're going to do is do a bird's eye view of the book of Genesis. We're going to do a survey of the book. We're going to sort of take a step back and look at the overall direction of the book of Genesis, and we're asking ourselves specifically then the question, what is the menu that Moses offers to this generation? What is the food that he feeds them in order to feed their faith? Obviously, it's clear from any understanding of Christian living as well as Bible teaching that the secret strength of faith always lies in the food that it feeds on. And if I can look at the book of Genesis to find out what kind of food Genesis feeds this young generation, it will teach me the kind of things that I need to teach my children so that they'll grow up to be men and women of faith. It teaches me the kind of things I need to preach on when I preach to my congregation or to my assembly so that our church will grow up to be men and women who are ready and able to believe God. It teaches me the kind of things I want to emphasize to the youth group in the church that I sponsor. It teaches me the kind of things I want to emphasize with that Bible class that I'll have this year. The kind of food, the kind of things that feed faith so that the generation that emerges will be a generation that's able to trust, believe, and obey. You see, the selling point on the menu that Moses offers is this. 38 years later, this generation faces the greatest opportunity of their life, and they used it. They were ready to trust. They were able to believe, they stepped forward in obedience, and they took the land. Now, I would like my children to be like that generation. That's why I need to feed them the kind of food that Genesis offers. I'd like the elders and deacons that I work with in the church, I'd like them to be that kind of generation. That's why I need to feed them the menu that Genesis has to offer. So we need to understand what that menu is. Well, there are 50 chapters in the book of Genesis. Are you ready for a survey of 50 chapters tonight? Well, I'm going to simplify it for you by telling you that from my perspective at least, the menu contains two main entrees. There are two main dishes. And as you take all the stories of the book of Genesis and take a step back, Moses is really saying to his generation and to our generation, you feed your faith on these two foods, and your faith will grow so that when opportunity knocks, you'll be ready to believe and willing to obey. Turn to Genesis chapter 1. The first chapter down to chapter 2, verse 3, is really the introduction to the book of Genesis. This introduction develops in three stages. The first stage is what is oftentimes called the title of the book. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." I propose to you that in all of the rest of the 1,189 chapters or whatever there are in the Bible, there is not a more profound phrase in all the Bible than the first four words of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God. Can you imagine anything in the Bible more profound than that statement? In the beginning, God. With one stroke of his pen, Moses introduces this young generation to their God. And he says in veiled language that he is the eternal one, that he is the absolutely sovereign one, that he is the totally self-sufficient one. And when he uses the name Elohim for God in this verse, he's saying that he's the mighty one, he's the powerful one, he's the strong one. And it's this God who calls into being all that exists. He creates the heavens and the earth. He is the originator. He is the source. He is the power of all that's part of this great universe. With one stroke of his pen, Moses introduces this young generation to their God. You know, the bulk of chapter 1, it takes us into the second phase, then, of this introduction. And it's called, of course, the 7 days of creation, or the 7 days of renovation, if you like. Verse 2 introduces us with a bit of a problem. The earth was formless and void. Now, the question is, was the earth created that way, or did the earth become that way? There are many Bible teachers who teach that the earth became that way. They do it on the basis of grammar. The verb that's used here, the earth was, is a verb that literally translated, the earth became without form and void. They do it on the basis of the fact that the only other time in the rest of the Bible that those two words are used side by side, formless and void, is in the book of Isaiah, where the prophet says, where God says through the prophet, that the earth was not created formless and void. So the conclusion is, that's not the way God originally made it. That's the way it became. And the theory is that it became that way as a result of the judgment of God upon the earth connected with the fall of Lucifer, the archangel in God's forces who rebelled against the Lord and fell in judgment. And with the fall of Lucifer and the judgment of Lucifer, there came a judgment upon the universe. And so the earth becomes formless, it becomes void, and there's darkness. Now that's a very significant term. Darkness is a spiritual term. It's a symbolic term. Darkness is upon the face of all of this, and that implies a judgment, that there has been a fall that has taken place, and that this is a fallen, judged scene. And in the midst of it all, the Spirit of God is moving. Then the verses that follow, of course, talk about the 6 days of God's activity. The first 3 days, God corrects the first problem. The earth was formless. God brings form out of the formlessness in the first 3 days. The second 3 days, he corrects the second problem. The earth was empty. And so in the next 3 days, God puts fullness into that emptiness. In those 6 days, then, God corrects the formlessness and the emptiness. And in the seventh day, God rests. Now, the question that every student of the Bible has is, what on earth is Moses doing in Genesis chapter 1? Is he giving us a historical account and record of creation? Well, I think it's fairly obvious to any of us who would take time to read through the chapter that while what Moses records is history and is historical, he is not giving us a historical account of creation. There are so many questions that are left unanswered. There are so many gaps that are open to us. We're saying, where did that darkness come from? How did this all happen? If Moses' purpose was to give us a historical record of the process of creation, there would be so much more that would be needed to be included. That's not his purpose here. Is Moses giving us then some material that we can use in combating the theory of evolution? Well, it's obvious again that what you have in Genesis chapter 1 is scientific. This is accurate. It's the truth of God. But God is not giving to us in Genesis chapter 1 as his purpose a scientific account that we can use in our defense of creation and in our attack on evolution. If that was God's purpose, it would be so much more material that would be valuable and be needed. Genesis raises so many questions and leaves so many questions unanswered to anyone who grapples with that area. So while it helps us and gives us information in dealing with that question, that's not the purpose of it. If that had been the purpose, there would have been so much more helpful information that would have been included so that we wouldn't have all the gaps and the unanswered questions that we all struggle with in that area. His purpose, then, is not to give us a historical account of creation. His purpose is not to give us a scientific record of the processes of creation. His purpose, ladies and gentlemen, his purpose is to introduce us to God. Because Moses knows that the secret strength of faith lies in the food that it feeds on. And when faith feeds on the character of God and the nature of God, faith grows. It becomes strong. The better we come to know God, the easier it is to trust God. That's not true with most of us in our relationships with people. Fact of the matter is, the better you get to know most people, the less you trust them. The fact of the matter is, the better you get to know God, the more you trust him. And you can't really trust God until you really come to know God. So Moses writes Genesis chapter 1 to teach this generation about their God. What does he teach them? Well, watch it very carefully now. What he teaches them is that he is the eternal God, that he is the self-sufficient God in the beginning, that he is the sovereign God, no one before him, no one mightier than him, no one above him. He is the sovereign God. He is the powerful, mighty God. He is the Elohim. He is the creator God, who is the primary cause behind all that is part of this universe. And then, the bulk of the chapter says, he is the God who took the earth when it was a real mess. It was formless. It was chaos. And he brought order out of that chaos. And he's a God who takes an earth that is just emptiness, and he puts fullness into it, and beauty, significance, design. That's what he does. Moses' intention, I propose to you, is to encourage the children of Israel, this young generation that's growing up, because what's happened to their nation is precisely what happened to the original earth. The original earth and its created beauty and in all of its perfection has fallen under the judgment of God because of the rebellion of Lucifer. The nation of Israel, recently created in the Exodus from the land of Egypt, now in all of its fullness and in all of its potential, has come to the edge of the land of Canaan and has rebelled against God. Has simply waved their fist in the face of God and said, we won't believe you, we can't believe you, we can't trust you to keep your word, and we're not going to trust you and obey you. And so in rebellion they've turned back, and now for 38 years the nation is formless and empty. The nation is in utter chaos, and there's no purpose, there's no design, there's no meaning, There's no significance. These young thinking teenagers had now become young moms and dads. They look at their nation. They say, good night, is there any hope for this nation? Look at the desperate mess that we're in. Look at the chaos that we're in. Moses says, hold it, let me tell you something. That's the way this old earth was one day. And let me tell you what God did. God took the formlessness of this earth and he brought beautiful form and order to it. He took the emptiness of this earth and he brought fullness back into that. And the God who did that for the world and the earth in Genesis chapter 1 is the very God who can do that for your nation in Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 14. That God who did that for the earth can do that for you. That God who did that for the earth is the very God who will do that for you and your nation. The story is designed to encourage this young generation, to give them confidence, to give them hope, to give them a future, because they're being introduced to a God who takes formlessness and emptiness and brings such beauty and such fullness and such design out of it that he's able ultimately to take a step back and say, that's very good. See, that's the purpose, ladies and gentlemen, of Genesis chapter 1, is to introduce these young couples, these new families, is to introduce them to their God. Because Moses knows that if they begin to know that God and understand that God, when the opportunity knocks, when the test comes, they'll be ready to trust him. Well, that's a wonderful perspective for us to have on God. Albert Einstein is the one who uncovered the theory of relativity. One day a reporter said to Mrs. Einstein, do you understand the theory of relativity? She thought for a moment and said, no, sir, I don't. But I know Albert, and he can be trusted. You see, that's Genesis chapter 1. That's the story of the Bible. There are lots of things that we don't understand, but if you know God, you can trust him. And the better you get to know God, the better you'll be able to trust him with decisions. The better you'll be able to trust him with crises. The better you'll be able to trust him when opportunity knocks and you have absolutely no idea how you're going to pull this off and survive. The secret, knowing God. How do you get to know God? Well, let me suggest a very, very simple agenda for you. Agenda number one, or item number one in the agenda, rather, I'd like to suggest to you is this. Whenever you read the Bible, whenever the Bible is read to you, the very first thing you want to do is look for God. Look for God. Because the Bible is a record, it's a revelation of God. When you're reading a historical incident, when you're reading a psalm, when you're reading a miracle in the New Testament, when you're reading one of those great theological passages in the New Testament, always, friends, always, always, the first question is, what do I learn about God? What quality of God's character is being demonstrated here? That's how you get to know God. Watching for him, looking for him, discovering him, seeing him on the pages of Scripture. My second item on my agenda is just as simple and just as profound. It's really for you men. Don't have to recommend it to women. But my recommendation to men is this. Read one good book about God every year. Now, the reason I don't need to recommend that to women is because my friends in Christian bookselling business tell me that 95% of people who buy books in their stores are women. And the other 5% are men who buy them but never read them. When was the last time you read a good book? When was the last time you read a good book about God? Now, if you women want to become part of the picture, you wives especially, here's my proposal. Every Christmas, or for your husband's birthday, buy him a book about God. There's absolutely nothing that you can give your husband that will be more enriching, and more beneficial and fruitful in his life. For all of us. Read a good book about God every year. When I was just breaking into my 20s, a person encouraged me to read a book about God. It's the first book I read about God. If I were to be honest with you, I would say to you, to this very day, apart from the Bible, it's the most influential book I've ever read. It's a book by A.W. Tozer. It's entitled The Knowledge of the Holy. Listen to me carefully. Chapter 1, paragraph 1, sentence 1 says this. What comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. Now, when I read that as a young 21 or 22-year-old fellow, I didn't believe it. It took that whole chapter for Tozer to convince me of it. But he did. He convinced me that what I do with my money is a reflection of what I think of God. He demonstrated to me that how I handle failure or how I handle success is really a reflection of what I think of God. He proved to me that how I deal with sin is really an indication of what I think about God. When it came to the end of the chapter, I was simply sold on it. Every area of my life, every aspect of my life, in one way or another, is a reflection of what I think about God. What comes into my mind when I think about God really is the most important thing about me, because that, more than any other thing, affects and determines how I live my life. So I read the rest of the book. And chapter after chapter, just short chapters, 3 or 4 pages each, gave me a cameo of this characteristic, a cameo of that attribute, a little picture of this feature, that facet, and I got a picture of what God was like. And it has given me a thirst that has never been quenched. I love to read books about God. I love to preach about the character of God. I've been so sold on it for the last 25 years. Every new ministry I have begun, every first ministry I've begun, the first thing I've done always is I've begun with preaching a series on the nature and character of God. I did it when we moved to London in 1975. For the first 3 months, Sunday morning and Sunday night, I preached on the character of God and the nature of God. And then 1983, we moved to Toronto, to Ontario Bible College, Ontario Theological Seminary. I was given the privilege of the president's chapels to speak to the student body. For that whole year, every chapel hour I had, I preached on the character of God and the nature of God. And that's because I wanted our students, I wanted our faculty, I wanted our staff to know God and to understand God and to come to so know Him that they'd be ready to trust Him and willing to step out in obedience to Him. And you can only do that when you get to know God. Read a good book about God. Do it regularly. Tozer's written a lovely book called The Pursuit of God. G.I. Packer's marvelous book, Knowing God. The book markets are crowded with good books about God. Read a good book about God every year. The third agenda item is to conduct regularly in your life God hunts. Have you ever had a God hunt? Karen and David Maines out of Chicago, who write to moms and dads about raising and training young children, recommend that what we do as parents is conduct God hunts with our children. When your child's been out in the backyard playing and fallen and some tragedy has happened in that child's life and they run into the kitchen and tears are streaming and they're at the end of the rope, then it's the time for mom to sit down or dad to sit down with their son or their daughter and conduct a God hunt. And what you do is you try to help your child to find God in what happened. Why do you think God allowed that? What's God teaching us? How can God help us deal with that? Conduct God hunts. As we get a little older, that's a wonderful thing to do when you're laying in bed at night, not able to go to sleep. Just to look back through the day, conduct a God hunt. What did I learn about God in that situation? What was God teaching me about Himself? It's a marvelous thing for us to do when we're driving in the car alone with nothing to do but to think. Conduct a God hunt. What did God teach me about himself? What am I learning about God? What is he showing me? You see, the better you and I get to know God, the more we will be ready to trust him and to step out in obedience to him. And that's why Genesis chapter 1, listen, is not only the chronological place to begin the Bible, but it is the theological place. You begin with God. That kind of food feeds faith. Well, I know you'll be encouraged. We only have 49 chapters to go. The next 49 chapters contain 10 stories. Each story is introduced with a phrase, "These are the generations of," or something similar. One of the modern translations, I believe, more helpfully translates it, and this is a record of what happened to. The first occurrence is in chapter 2, verse 4. This is the account of the records of the earth, of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Literally, this is a record of what happened to the heavens and the earth, and that introduces the first story. Now, I'm not going to take you through Genesis to point out the 10 stories, but there's many of the stories you will know, and some of them we're going to be looking at. But that phrase at the beginning of chapter 2, verse 4, occurs 10 times in the book of Genesis. It introduces the 10 stories. Now, my question to you, and you've got to think with me just a little bit in our last 5 or 7 minutes, if you will, please. We've got to think through this. Why does Moses tell these stories? You see, that's the question that any thoughtful Bible reader has to ask. He could have told us enough from the life of Abraham to fill up the book of Genesis. Why did he choose what he chose from the life of Abraham? I'd love to know so much more about the story of Joseph, wouldn't you? Why does he tell us so little? Why does he tell us what he does tell us? You see, that's the question.